You mean therefore for faults committed after death, which is infinity? Being answered yes, he replied, what is the soul? Mr. K. replied, a part of God. He answered, precisely. How, then, can God annihilate even a part of himself? Sooner or later a soul will turn to God, but it may be countless ages before that happens. He then ceased. Chapter 6, He Falls from the Astral Plane into Hell. Second letter from Officer 9:50 PM same date. One day, if so I can call it, when we went to one of the seances, I suddenly recognized an old enemy of mine. This man I hated. He had helped to bring about an exposure of my methods. I had learned to control one of these mediums, as described in my last letter. As soon as I saw him, a wild desire to be revenged arose in my mind. There were plenty of spirits at hand to suggest methods. One was that I should get hold of some hooligans and make them murder him, another, to wreck him financially, and so forth. But a far more ingenious method occurred after a while to me. I found that he had begun to dabble in the occult. He did not know much about it, and his motives were by no means exalted, being in the main curiosity. I haunted him day by day and watched his every movement. Whenever an opportunity occurred, I did him an evil turn. If he played cards, I told his opponent what cards he held, and so he lost money. I put in men's minds a vague sense of suspicion and distrust concerning his most innocent acts. But this sort of thing was not the ultimate aim of my attentions. At last my chance came, as I knew it would. He had been endeavoring to get outside his body as he described it. He had no noble aim, and his guide's power had grown weak from various causes, and so when he at length did go out of his body, for about the third time, I came in. Ha! Ha! I chuckled, as once more I found a body clothing me. This is like old times. But it wasn't. I found that it was only by the exertion of my willpower that I was able to retain control of this borrowed carcass. Anyone with a weaker personality than mine would soon have been compelled to go out again, but I was a far more powerful character than he, and I held it for as long as was necessary. Then I set to work to pay off old scores, and commenced by wrecking his home. I seemed to everyone to be the man himself who all the time was hanging on, still attached by the vital cord to the body, which he nevertheless could not re-enter. I treated his wife so badly that she soon left him in disgust, taking their child with her, and instituted divorce proceedings. I gave rein to all the lusts, such as drink, which could damage his body, and dragged his good name in the gutter by various shady practices. Yet I took care to keep clear of the law. But I had to work quickly and soon completed my task thus. I went to a jeweler's shop, stole a quantity of jewels, murdered the man who owned them, and managed to get caught in my enemy's body. I still held on to that body until it had been formally committed on the charge of murder, and then in the cell I left it. As I did so, I jeered at the waiting spirit who hastened to clothe itself again. When the case came up for trial, I was there, though invisible. The man maintained that he knew nothing of all the facts stated against him, as of course he didn't. Though he knew it as a spirit, he had not been able to register it on his physical brain. His barrister tried the plea of temporary insanity, but, as the judge said in summing up, some people argue that all sin is insanity, but we cannot accept that. There is far too much method in this madness. The facts borne out by all the witnesses show that this was only the culminating and logical conclusion of those other detestable acts to which even his wife in her separation suit has borne witness. Then came the usual penalty, death. Now my joy was almost complete, but gradually various things intervened to mar it. He still vowed his innocence, and this though it made no difference to his ultimate fate. Further, his wife, who, in spite of his genuine faults, loved him still, and of course knew him well, believed him when he declared that he had no recollection of all his various misdeeds. She accepted the view that he had been temporarily insane. This had the effect of softening his rebellious spirit, which at first seemed likely to drag him down at the moment of death and make him join us. The prison chaplain also believed him and consoled him, despite all I could do to prevent it. In short, When we gathered at the execution, expecting an angry and revengeful spirit who would be compelled to join us, and over whom I, having a stronger personality, could dominate, we found quite a band of spirits of light, who surrounded him with a guard and kept us at bay and took him away whither we knew not. These events took place in the United States. Suddenly I became aware of the fact that a change was taking place in me. My psychic body seemed to be slipping from me, and, strive as I would, I could not hold it. "Where am I going?" I cried to the evil guide who haunted me. "To hell," he replied, "don't you think it's time? But you said that by doing these things I should keep nourishing this psychic body?" "For a time," I said, "and so you did. Anyway, you are leaving it now. What is this other body in which I am clothed?" I cried despairingly. "Your spiritual body," he answered, "and in it you will really begin to suffer." And as he spoke I realized how he gloated over me. How I loathed him. But it was so, and was in hell and not yet at the bottom. That, alas, was still to come. But I have written enough tonight. There is a warning in almost every line of this, so do not think these revelations are unnecessary. Study them and think them over. Mr. L. will now take control to close. Goodbye for the present. The Officer. Chapter 7, In Hell. The City of Hate, Rome. Letter from the Officer, March 28, 1913, 9:30. The Officer. When I left off last time, I had told you that I had at length sunk into hell itself. This was different in many ways from the earth plane. I seemed to be falling through space, black, dark, and horrible. At length I reached what appeared to be firm ground, for I discovered a kind of path, and scrambling onto this made my way along it as best I could. Every now and then I slipped off into the horrible filth. All was utter darkness, and the marvel was that I got along at all. I felt drawn in a certain direction by some strange attraction, and ultimately found myself on a desolate, stony plain which appeared to be covered with ashes. Still drawn on through the darkness, I stumbled and struggled on, longing for some human society, be it never so degraded. Then gradually I began to get a sort of half-sight, and by means of it was able dimly to perceive that I was drawing near to some huge mass, which in time grew into the walls and battlements of a great city. Soon I stood before it and saw that it stretched right away as far as I could perceive, though this was not far. There was a gateway, and towards it I turned my steps. No sooner had I come in front of it and noticed that it was built in the manner of a great Roman gateway than what seemed to be doors opened and I passed in. I had hardly done so, when a fiendish yell rang out, and two hideous beings, who apparently acted the part of wardens of the gate, sprang at me. Then I knew that all spirits I should meet here would be enemies, and I turned savagely upon them prepared to battle for life. I was almost going to say, but of course that sounds absurd. Fight, however, I would, and even as I made up my will to do it, the wretched creatures turned and fled. Thus I learned my first lesson about hell. There is no law here. The strongest oppresses the weakest, and strength lies in the will and in the intellect. I pursued my way unmolested for a time, and found that I could now distinguish the various buildings as through a dense fog. Gradually the idea grew upon me that I recognized this city. It was ancient Rome. Yes, but far more than that, for to it had been added all the buildings which had been built there since the days of the Caesars, and in time I learned the truth. This was the spirit city of Rome, and many other cities, built of the buildings in which had been committed all the deeds of cruelty and hate. All the evil emanations which had been thrown off by its former inhabitants had gone to build up this imperial city of hell. Its better emanations had gone elsewhere, to the realms above, and this is the fate of every city or building on earth. Its evil side is dragged down to hell, just as its pure form goes to the realms of half-belief or of full belief. Here I found was not only Rome, but Venice and Milan, and a thousand other cities in which hate and cruelty had reigned. This vast city is not the only city in hell. There are countless others. To each of these cities of hate the damned are drawn, according as the natural laws of attraction act, some to one, some to another. Besides cities of hate, there are many others, such as the cities of lust, Paris and London may be found there. London, or parts of it, may be found in many of these cities, each part differing, for London at different times has had many different forms. Through the dirty, foul, and yet splendid streets I wended my way. Often I met men and women, many of them clad apparently in the kind of clothes they wore on earth. But these robes were foul and torn. Some of them rushed at me to attack me, but each one I was able to repel by means of my willpower. Then an idea came to me. Why should I not attack one of them, make him my slave, and compel him to tell me about this new city in which I had to dwell? Acting on this, I sprang at a man, who turned with a shriek and fled. But I willed that he should come to me, and slowly he crawled back, struggling all the while. When I had him, I made him grovel in anguish, just to show him I was master, then bade him rise and show me the sights of the place. Whining, he did so, and led me to various buildings. "Would you like to see a gladiatorial show?" he inquired. "Yes," I cried. Soon we were in what seemed like the Colosseum, and I saw that the place was full. Seizing a man, I hurled him out. There was a foul-looking woman seated next, and I threw her out also. We two then sat down. The show had just begun, and I saw that opposite us was a great royal box. "Yonder is the emperor," whispered my slave in an awestruck voice. "Which?" I inquired. "I don't know, but he is the emperor, and he rules this part of the city." "Are there several emperors here?" I inquired. "Yes, many, and kings and generals too. Don't they quarrel?" "Quarrel? Where have you come from, stranger?" "We all quarrel here. This is the city of hate and cruelty. We are constantly fighting against each other, district against district, emperor against emperor. We have just conquered a district near here, and therefore the emperor is celebrating his victory by making the prisoners fight with the gladiators." "Here they come then," began the most ghastly show I have ever witnessed. All the horrors of an ancient gladiatorial show without one redeeming feature were enacted before our eyes. There was no noble martyrdom to relieve the beastliness of the whole show. It was not merely men against men, but men against women, and even against children. Tortures of every description were inflicted, and the wretched victims shrieked and screamed. It was just as if the scene was on earth, save that no death came to release the victims. On and on it went. Now, as I write it and you read it, the effect is to produce a sense of pity and nausea. But at that time the effect was the reverse. It pandered to my worst side and roused a fierce lust of cruelty and hate, and so it did in others. This was the object of the emperor. Now farewell. I will write more another day. The officer. Chapter. The emperor. A theater in hell. Trance conversation with the officer. The presence of H. J. L. March 30th. The newcomer's face was as I described it when I saw him clairvoyantly. It was a strong face, but not a pleasant one. Nevertheless, I thought it looked much less marked with evil than it had done when last I saw him. I greeted him in a friendly spirit, and he at once took up the thread of his narrative where he had dropped it in his last letter. The officer. At length the show was over, and as we dispersed, my slave and I took up our positions near a gateway to watch the egress of the emperor. Soon a wild throng appeared around the emperor's chariot. I noticed many spirits, both male and female, quite naked. I said to my slave, "This is the first time I have seen naked spirits. We always seem to clothe ourselves by instinct." __ He replied, "These are compelled to assume this shape by the emperor to amuse his evil passions." The officer. "It is not possible for them, though, to have relations one with the other, is it?" Slave. "Surely, master, you must know by now that, having no physical bodies, we cannot enjoy any physical pleasures. We can pretend to do these things, but it is all a hollow sham, a vain pretense. Our passions burn as fiercely as ever, but we have no bodies with which to gratify them." "What, are there animals in hell?" I cried, as several great hunting dogs dashed past us. He replied, "No, these are the spirits of men and women whom the emperor compels to assume this shape, just as the others are compelled to appear naked or as children." He is so powerful that he can compel us to assume any shape he chooses, even that of his furniture. The latter is a favorite amusement of his. The procession passed amid scenes of the wildest debauchery and cruelty. A long shriek of anguish rose as it slowly passed along. Various forms of torture were being inflicted, sometimes on the members of the imperial cortege, and sometimes on the spectators who lined the route. In particular, I noticed that the dogs were repeatedly set to worry some of the women and men in the procession, or to drag spectators before the emperor. On he rode in this chariot, the picture of cruelty and pride. His face was so lined by evil that it was almost impossible to realize what his original features had been like. I should think, however, that in his youth on earth he had been a handsome man, but evil had almost obliterated this. "Who is he?" I inquired. "Is he Nero?" My slave replied, "No, master. I have forgotten who he was, but I do know he is not Nero. Nero is a slave to this man. Nero is a very feeble being compared with the emperor, and though he has several times tried to raise rebellion against the emperor, the latter has always crushed him sooner or later. Still, Nero is very cunning, and often escapes from the vigilance of those who have to guard him. Each time he is caught, the emperor inflicts the most excruciating torments upon him. Indeed, torturing Nero is one of the emperor's favorite amusements." "But surely you must know who the emperor was when alive?" I inquired. "I've forgotten, if I ever knew." "You liar, you don't forget. Tell me at once." As I could get nothing out of him, I began to imagine the most horrible torments I could devise, and by willing that he should suffer them, caused him to writhe in anguish. As, however, he evidently did not know the name, I at last grew tired of this amusement and bade him rise and show me something else to entertain me. "I will take you to a theatre," he answered. "What sort of performance do you have here?" "Oh, extremely clever and exciting. They deal with all the famous cases of hate and cruelty which have occurred on earth, and if possible our managers try to get the original persons to reenact the same scenes here as on earth." "Don't you have anything dealing with lust or drink?" "They come in as subsidiary parts of the plot, but this is the city of hate and cruelty, and, therefore, that is the dominant inspiration of all our plays here. In the cities of lust it is, of course, lust that dominates. Still, as the latter often produces cruelty, we see a fair number of representations of it and of other pleasant vices." "Are any fresh plays composed here?" "Not many, and those are but a reshuffling of the ideas which have been enacted on earth. However, there are plenty of real dramas of cruelty being enacted on earth every day, so we are never at a loss for a new play." "Nothing original ever comes out of hell, I suppose?" I inquired. "Nothing, so far as I know, but plenty or perversions and parodies from elsewhere." We now stood before the doors of a great theatre. We had walked some distance, and here the buildings seemed fairly modern. The theatre certainly was quite modern, but it looked dirty and neglected. The latter was, however, certainly not the case. On the contrary, people were hurrying through the doors in considerable numbers. We went with the crowd, and, once through the door, our ears were assailed by a fearful noise, due to the fact that almost everyone was quarreling with his next door neighbor, either alleging that he had pushed him or that he had tried to rob him, or for some other pretended reason. At the booking office, a constant wrangle seemed to be in process between the booking clerk and each person who came demanding a seat. Annoyed by the continual row, I called up all my willpower and, despite the angry protests of the crowd, forced my way through to the booking office, dragging my slave with me. The latter, safe under my protection, did his best to hurt several of those we passed, and succeeded in catching a woman by the hair and throwing her on the ground, where the crowd ruthlessly trampled her underfoot. We made for the stalls, and on entering the theatre proper I perceived that nearly half the audience was engaged in quarrelling and fighting. Close by us in the stalls a man and woman were fighting. They had evidently been people of good social position on earth, and their clothes, though dirty and torn, had at one time been expensive and fashionable. Yet these two fought like any people from the slums might have done, and as we watched, the man, who was evidently the stronger willed, dashed the woman to the ground between the seats. He deliberately stamped upon her and then sat down on his seat and used her body as a footstool, pounding her every now and then, if she attempted to rise. Seeing us, he signaled us to pass him, adding, "Don't mind her, just walk over her. I like to make a carpet of her, it does her good." To emphasize this, he gave her a savage kick in the jaw. We walked across her to some seats beyond him which were vacant. It was a most extraordinary sensation, for her body felt like real flesh and blood, and she squirmed and shrieked as if alive. Of course, she really did feel sufferings similar to those she would have felt on Earth under the circumstances, but though our actions here show forth our wills, it is our wills which inflict the pain. Seated next to us were two women. Handsome they must have been at one time, but they were rendered hideous by the expression of the most fiendish cruelty which overspread their faces. Their eyes were steel blue-gray, and the hair golden in hue. I surveyed them carefully for a minute or two, and then the one nearest to me, who said her name was Rose, spoke. "Well, I seem to fascinate you. What do you think of me?" I answered, "I think you were handsome once, but your cruelty has spoilt your looks. Still, one can't be too particular in hell. You'll do, and your friend also. I shall take you both." "Well, we've got to be consulted first," she replied, "and I don't intend to go with you." I seized her hands at once. "Down on your knees and place your neck beneath my heel," I hissed. For a brief moment she tried to resist, then fell groaning and sobbing at my feet, and did as I bade her. "Now sit back in your seat and remember you are my slave," I said, and then, addressing the other, continued, "What's your name?" "Violet." "Indeed, a pretty name like your companion's, especially for such a cruel devil as you are. However, I'm more savage still, so you had better obey me at once. Down on your knees and do as Rose did." She did so without a murmur. After a little desultory conversation, the curtain rose and the noise of quarreling gradually subsided as the plot unfolded itself. I do not propose to give you that plot. It suffices to say that though lust and vice of every description were there enacted in full detail before our eyes, it passed to its culminating point in the torture chamber of the Inquisition. My male slave, who had been sitting quietly up to now, here whispered, "We had better fly now, master." At the end of this scene, the inquisitors invariably raid the audience and carry some of them onto the stage to torture them. Even as he ceased, the Grand Inquisitor stepped forward, and, pointing at him, cried, "Come here, wretched man," and the miserable creature, with livid terror written on his features, rose, and, as if drawn against his will, began to make his way out of his seat and towards the stage. I at once resented this, for he was my slave, and, once taken from me, I might not be able to recover him. It was an open assault on my domination, and I could not permit it. I rose at once. "Let that man alone, he is mine. If you want to torture someone fresh, torture yourself." A low shriek of excitement passed round the theater as the audience scented a fierce battle. The chief inquisitor glared at me. "You are evidently a stranger here, or you would not dare to thus openly defy me. Well, it's time you learnt your first lesson. Come up on to this stage and do battle with me." "No, come down here," I answered. And then began a fierce battle between our wills. I have always had an iron will, and it stood me in good stead that day. The magnetic attraction sent out from the stage was tremendous, but I successfully resisted and willed that he should come to me. For a long time we thus struggled, when suddenly a yell broke from the audience. My enemy had been compelled to move a step forward. Next instant, however, he had sprung back again, and I felt myself jerked forward sharply. The yell from the audience had made my mind wander for a moment, but at once I redoubled my efforts, and ere long again he stepped towards me. This time, however, there was no return, again another step, and then he began to move slowly towards the edge of the platform. At the edge he hesitated and struggled desperately, then with a wild shriek pitched forward into the orchestra, the members of which scattered in all directions. A wild yell of delight arose from all who saw it. Then he rose and crawled slowly towards me, climbing over the stalls, and the audience got out of his way, for they still feared him. At length he knelt on the stool in front of me. Then I spoke, "Go back to the stage, and I will follow." I drove him before me, now completely beaten, vaulted lightly onto the stage, and there made his assistant inquisitors inflict all their most devilish torments upon him. The applause was deafening, and when we had seen enough and I turned to get down from the stage, a great shout arose. "You shall be our emperor, raise the standard of revolt against the tyrant." But it did not suit me to enter at once on conflict with that powerful will. I needed to know more about this city before I attempted anything so risky. At the same time I knew that the conflict was bound to come, and knew also that it would be impossible to hide for long what had happened at the theater. Once the emperor knew what had happened, he would scent danger and take measures accordingly. I therefore replied, "Silence, I have no wish to rule here. So long as I am not attacked by him, I shall remain loyal to the emperor." At these words a titter ran round the building, and several murmured, "He's afraid." "Silence, you dogs," I shouted. "If you breathe one word of what has happened here, I will inflict the most horrible tortures on you that it is possible to imagine." "The emperor will defend us from you," yelped a man in the stalls. In an instant I had him on the stage and bade the inquisitors flay him alive. If I use such material language, it is because by no other means can I convey what was done. It looked like flaying to the audience, and felt like it to the man, but of course there was no physical skin to flay. Nevertheless, the result was the same. Then I dismissed the spectators, and, calling to me the two women and my slave, myself left the building. "I suppose you can find me a house?" I inquired of the man. "Yes, master." "What of this one?" "It belongs to a well-known murderer, an Italian of the Renaissance. I think you would find it more convenient than one of the ancient Roman villas." "This will do," I answered. We hammered at the door and a manservant opened it and struck at me. In a moment I had hurled him on the floor. "Stamp on his face," I cried to my women, and Rose did so with the greatest delight. I rushed up a flight of marble stairs, all cracked and filthy, and into a large salon. Here the master of the house sat surrounded by women. I sprang at him and hurled him out of the window, and appropriated for my own use the house and all it contained, including women and servants. "Now, I think that is sufficient for this time." He rose, but I, J.W., said, "Please stop a moment. I want to ask you one or two questions." H.J.L. thereupon remarked, "You had better be quick, for you have been here long enough." I nodded, and asked, "Can you give me any details about the gladiators which are likely to be unknown to the historians of the present day?" "Officer, I don't exactly know how much they know, but I expect they are fairly well up in the subject. There is, I believe, a fair amount of evidence about. Perhaps, however, you don't know this fact. The gladiators advanced on one side in a sort of triangle and on the other in a solid phalanx. As soon as the triangle or point of the wedge struck the phalanx, the latter divided like a pair of scissors and then closed on the sides of the wedge. Do you understand this?" "Quite," I, J. W., replied. "And which is the correct rendering of thumbs reversed? Is it up or down to save the man?" He smiled grimly. "I am afraid I cannot answer that query. No question of saving any gladiator ever arose. Firstly, of course, they can't die, and, secondly, no one in the city of hate ever desired to save any man from suffering. Half the interest in these shows lay in the fact that the victor tortured his conquered foe." "Now," interposed H. J. L., "you must return." Chapter 9, A Visit to the Emperor. Trance Conversation, April 6. The officer's narrative continued. "I do not think it necessary to give you in detail all that befell me in hell. I set to work to gather round me a band of adherents. From them I demanded and obtained absolute obedience, but I allowed them to patrol the streets in bands, and attack and ill-treat all and sundry who fell into their hands. Large numbers of former brigands and pirates, together with soldiers of fortune belonging to every age and country, hastened to join my bands. At length the inevitable happened. I received a summons to appear before the emperor. I went, accompanied by a number of my retainers. As soon as we entered the presence chamber, a magnificent but dirty hall, the emperor rose from his throne.